Okay, everyone. So, welcome to this ongoing series on the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha. And the sutta is interesting precisely because, as I mentioned before, it is the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya, and as such, it kind of sets out a vision of the world, of reality. It's like the Sammaditti right view is the beginning of the spiritual path. In the same way, this is a particular way of showing that Sammaditti, the right view, so that you start the path in a sense. But it's quite a profound way of thinking about Sammaditti. It is specifically about the insight into the nature of the mind and whether human beings or animals or anyone, whether you continue when you die or whether you stop or whether there is a third way. And what we have looked at so far are all the theories that have to do with it's called the past, but they are usually around somehow involved with eternalism in a certain way. In Buddhism, we have all this idea that we have eternalism and then you have annihilationism, which means that you stop when you die. And then there's the third way, which is the way of the Buddha, which is the way of dependent origination, which means you carry on if you crave and you don't carry on if you stop. It's like the third path in this way of looking at the world. So far we have looked at things that have to do with like an eternal mind, eternal consciousness, things that are similar to Indian ideas of Advaita Vedanta, the non-duality tradition in India. We looked at things that have to do with a creator God creating the world. We looked at theories that have to do with things arising out of, by chance, a bit maybe like modern ideas of cosmology, where the Big Bang, just suddenly a miracle, bang, Big Bang, the big miracle happening. And there's also a few things we have seen that have to do with people who are confused. They don't know what the truth is. They're called the Amaravikepaka, which means like the eel wrigglers or the people who are equivocators. They don't have a specific stand on anything, and they're just kind of that's what they say basically. So that is the theories about the past. Not entirely clear always why they are theories about the past, but they are. And now we're going to talk about the theories of the future. And these are very similar to the theories of the past in the sense that they deal mostly with eternalism. Yeah, the idea that things carry on forever. This is the most important part of kind of wrong views are the eternalist views, because there is a general tendency for humans or any being to want to exist. Yeah, so eternalism is usually more fashionable than annihilationism. Annihilationism also fashionable to some people, but not as fashionable. So these are the kind of various ways. Now we're going to look more at these various eternalist views, but here about the future. So this is like speculation about the future, maybe also based on some degree of meditation experience and these kind of things. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about these views about the future. And you have it there. I'm sure that. So there are some ascetics and Brahmins, these are the kind of spiritual people and the philosophers of ancient India who theorize about the future and assert various hypotheses concerning the future on 44 grounds. We have seen 18 grounds before on the past, 44 plus 18 is 62, so this comprises all of the grounds. What are the 44 grounds on which they rely? Okay, it's exciting. Let's see now what comes up. This is why I have a bit of control here so I can make it more exciting. Go slowly, see what happens. So first of all, we have views on being percipient, after death. You carry on after that, you are percipient. Percipient just means that you are conscious. You are aware of something. Yeah, percipient means a particular kind of consciousness where you see things mentally in a certain way. So you are percipient, you have perception. Having perception is another way of talking about this. So what are these theories? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who say there is life after death and assert that the self lives on after death in a percipient form on 16 grounds. What are the 16 grounds on which they rely? The self lives on or carries on after death. Yeah, the Pali word atta again. And lives on. What is the Pali? Can't remember now. I think it is hoti. It just exists after you die. And so there's 16 grounds on which you can talk about this. So what are those 16 grounds? Let's have a look. They assert the self is well and percipient after death, and it is physical. So these are the characteristics that they give to this self. Remember, these are theories. They can be based on meditation experience. They can be based on merely intellectualizing, coming up with some fancy idea. Any way that you arrive at this, doesn't matter what the way is. The point is that the Buddha is going to show that whatever way you arrive at it, still it is not really satisfactory here. So the self is well. This is arogo. Arogo means literally without illness. Yeah, which is a little bit perhaps strange, without illness. What exactly does that mean? What would it mean that the self is ill or sick? What is the kind of the point here? And the way this is explained in the commentary is it explained that it is not changeable. Yeah, that it is kind of, it has a permanence to it. This is the idea of this word here. And of course, if we think about illness, well, what is the problem with illness? The problem is that there is a change in the body and you feel bad about it, right? There's a sense of dukkha with it. That is why illness is not really, we don't want to get sick and ill. And so all kinds of impermanence have that similar kind of problem to them. You don't want things to be impermanent, because impermanence is always unpleasant, because you get used to things. This is the way the world is. And then someone comes and knocks it over and you have to kind of get used to a new situation. So the idea that arogo might mean that things are fixed and they are stable and they don't change, I think it's a reasonable extension perhaps of the idea of illness. So it is possible that it's used in this way. This is what the commentary says anyway, and I'm not sure if there is any better explanation for it. So I'd kind of take that as my standard in this case. And then it is percipient after death. Well, this is what we have looked at already. And then it is physical. And the idea that it is physical is perhaps a little bit strange. The Pali word here is actually rupi or rupin, having form, quite literally. And so I think that is would have been a better translation in this case, to say that it has form, yeah? Because form is often just like a shape. Something has shape. And even a mental thing, yeah? If you have like a mental self or whatever, it may not be physical in the sense of material things in this way, but it can still have a shape. Like, you know, you see something in your mind's eye, yeah? Even though there's no feeling of anything physical, there's still a shape there. That to me perhaps probably makes more sense in this kind of context, especially as we come further down, it starts to make more sense to think of it as having shape rather than actually being physical in an ordinary sense. That also opens up the ideas here. So these are the ideas, and one of the purposes of the Buddha here is really just to kind of make a list of all possible ways that someone might come up with the idea of a self. Yeah, so some of these ways may seem strange, and you may wonder, what does it mean? And the idea, the most important thing is not exactly what they mean, because people may have come up with these things in really weird ways. I think the commentary said something like, these are the views of, what does it say? These are the views of madmen, or something like that, some of these views. So they have been arrived at through some dodgy ways of thinking. Yeah, the point is just that they are not acceptable regardless of how you arrive at them. So then we have the one that is non-physical, yeah, so you are, or hasn't any shape. The self is well, or it is permanent, percipient after death, and it's doesn't have anything physical. It's arupi. So this might be something like the immaterial attainments, yeah, something like that, that are then assumed to carry on forever after. So you can get an idea here of what is going on. Yeah, maybe you attain some very profound state of samadhi or something, and then you think, yeah, this is it. Yeah, this is so nice. This must be real. It feels so real. This feels like the real deal. Okay, it's got to be permanent. And this is one of the kind of the problems with that we are looking at here, is this idea that when we attain something, when you have a deep state of samadhi or whatever, unless you have some philosophical framework that helps you to understand those states, you will understand them in terms of underlying defilements, underlying desires that are there. And because we all have this underlying desire to exist, actually not everyone has that, but assuming that you have the underlying desire to exist, you will naturally tend towards eternalist interpretations. So if you see a mind that is really powerful, really stable, really unified, yeah, you attain it in meditation, you think, whoa, yes, this is it. Yeah, the body is gone. When I die, well, when I die, the body will also be gone. So this is where I will be after I die. Yeah. So this is the tendency of the human mind to see things in this way, to misinterpret them. Yeah. And this is precisely the problem that we are dealing with here, this misinterpretation of reality here. Yeah. All the way through. And sometimes it takes someone very profound, like the Buddha, to see through that, because it feels like we exist, right? This is the problem. Deep down, we feel like we exist in a certain way. And so then we project that feeling onto the experiences that we have. And this is where the problem arises. So what are these... So let's carry on. So for all of the various possibilities. So it's non-physical. It is both physical and non-physical. Yeah, this would then be like our experience, I suppose, where you have both physical aspect and non-physical aspect. But then somehow it is permanent as well. So you have a shape, maybe, and that shape is permanent, and then that kind of has both parts to it. It is neither physical nor non-physical. This would be something like the fourth immaterial attainment, the nevasanya nasanya ayatana, the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. Yeah, something like that. And then you overreach. You get that, you reach that attainment. You have something very valuable and powerful, and then you misinterpret it. You misunderstand it. You overreach. You go beyond the evidence. The evidence is just that you had this attainment. But then you interpret, you put something into that is not actually there. You get to the conclusion, this is permanent. Yeah, this is how these things work. And that is where the problem is. So the problem is not the attainment. The problem is the interpretation of that attainment. And all the way through, this is the problem. All right, so let's go on to the next view ideas here. That this self, which is well, it is percipient after death, and it is finite. It is limited. Yeah, most experiences we have are finite. This we can have a limited perception, like here. You can only see so much. There's a limitation to it. But there are also experiences that are infinite, infinite. Yeah, these are, again, deep experiences in samadhi. You have a feeling that there's no limit to anything. Everything just goes potentially on forever. You may not, it's not as if you can experience forever, but you can experience that there is no limit to things. They are both finite and infinite. We have some examples of this before, where it's kind of infinite in one direction, but not in another. And then they are neither finite nor infinite. Maybe something like the sphere of nothingness. Yeah, imagine that you have the sphere of nothingness and there's nothing there. You cannot say it is limited or unlimited because there's nothing. So the ideas of finite and infinite don't really apply anymore. Yeah, it's just there's nothing. You experience nothing. Yeah. It's a very strange state. How can you experience nothing here? It's kind of weird, but that's kind of the point. So that's kind of probably what is going on here. And then again, in every of these cases, you go beyond the evidence, you see permanence in what is just an experience, and you go too far in your inference as to what actually is there. Then we have some more. We have, again, we're dealing with percipient after, it is well percipient after death, and it has unified perception. Ekatta sanya. This again is things where the perception is completely stable, like a jhana state or something like that, yeah? It has diverse perception. So in other words, you see multiple things, like a picture or something like that, which is, has many things going on. Diverse perception. Limited perception. This means like you have like our ordinary state or even lesser states of samadhi. They have a limited scope to them, a limited span. And then you have the limitless perception or unlimited perception. These again are the immaterial attainments specifically. These are standard descriptions in the suttas of samadhi, how samadhi in various forms and ordinary experience of various forms can how what kind of experiences you can have. These people who have these experiences, they overinterpret them. They add things to the experience that isn't actually in the experience itself. If you think about it, I think I mentioned this last time, is that there is no such thing as an experience that that is the equivalent of permanence. Yeah, it's impossible to have such an experience. You cannot know that something is permanent, always going to be there. All you have is the thing that is in front of you right now. And if you say this is permanent, well, you're always making a deduction or an inference. You're going beyond the evidence that you have. No, there's no perception that can be like that. So for that reason, anyone who says that something is permanent, you know straight away that actually they're going beyond the evidence. It's impossible to know such a thing. That's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Because it kind of undermines some of the kind of favorite ideas about religion in the world. It experiences nothing but happiness. This would be like the high jhana realms. It experiences nothing but suffering. It's a bit rough. This would be like the hell realm or something like that. Yeah, you get reborn in hell. And here again, you have this idea that the hell is permanent. Yeah. So this is a bit like some ideas you have like in Christianity, perhaps. You go to hell and you stay there forever because you believed in the wrong religion. You were a Buddhist. And then you go into hell forever as a consequence. That's really unfair, isn't it? So this is here. It's already there in the suttas, long before Christianity. It's kind of right there. So these are things that people have thought about since the beginning, the dawn of time, as they say. As if there were such a thing. Experience of both happiness and suffering, like human beings or some of the devas. Experiences neither happiness nor suffering. So this again is like the fourth jhana beings. Pretty much everyone is included in this. Can you think of anything apart from this? Happiness, suffering, both and neither. I don't know if there is any further alternatives. So the idea, of course, is that everything is included. There is no experience. There is no consciousness or samadhi state or anything beyond this. This is all inclusive in terms of percipient beings, at least. So there you are. So this is the idea of percipient after death, who is well, who is the arogo, meaning that it is immutable or eternal, not subject to change. That's kind of the whole point of this, that things go on forever afterwards. So I think it is actually very likely that arogo, non-illness, actually means that it is permanent and not change. It's a little bit strange why they use that word. I don't really understand why they use that word. It's one of those mysteries of the suttas. There's always a few mysteries unexplained. What do people think about this? Does it make any sense to anyone? Anything? Ananda? Microphone coming? Use this one. Okay, great. Yep.
Ajahn, on that just experiences, no, the happiness, no suffering, could it be referring to these equanimous states?
Which states?
Equanimity.
Equanimity, yeah, that's the fourth jhana.
Fourth jhana, so that is...
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Well, it could also be the immaterial realms. Could be the asanyasatta, the perception, the beings that have no perception. Some of those ones. Yeah.
Asanyatala.
Asanyasatta is is mentioned a couple of times in the suttas. I don't know what it is, but that's they mentioned.
Is that this asanya tala? Is that supposed to be a very, though it is in a higher realm, but it is not that much, what am I trying to say, not that much sought after, because you are just there for just, you don't feel anything, you don't, one doesn't feel anything, one doesn't know anything.
Yeah, from a Buddhist point of view, it's not much point to being reborn there because you're kind of just stuck there for a while, you come out afterwards and you haven't learned anything here, so it's not all that useful, I agree. But I guess if you have a craving that says, oh, I don't want to experience because experience is dukkha and I just want to get out of all this, then the mind might incline towards that and then realize that state. So in that sense, it might be sought after, a craving might seek it out. But in terms of wisdom, it doesn't really, I don't think it has much point to it.
At all. So it's attaining some higher state, but which is turning into something of utterly useless.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Above somewhere, and you had that finite state.
Yeah.
Finite, because it's referring to that permanent self in the totality of that, in those two sentences. This may not be then referring to finite in terms of time.
Yeah.
So it may be finite in terms of the extent of the consciousness. Or would that be right?
Yeah, that would be right. So it would be a perception that you have now, the perception of space, like infinite space or infinite consciousness, something like that. That would be exactly. Yep.
Thank you.
All right. So, any further comments on this? The physical self or the form self? Yeah. This is almost like philosophy class in Buddhism almost. It's kind of... All right, let's carry on then. So these are the 16 grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self lives on after death in a percipient form. They have perception. Oui. Go away. Okay. Any ascetics and Brahmins who assert that the self lives on after death in a percipient form do so on one or other of these 16 grounds. Yeah? The idea outside of this there is none. The idea that this is all-inclusive, there is no further way of talking about this. The idea is that this is Brahma's net, right? Remember the idea of the sutta, Brahmajala Sutta, the net of Brahma, which catches all the views in the world, or I should say all the wrong views in the world, catches them in this net and kind of, I guess, gets rid of them. Yeah, we kind of, as if we were catching rubbish or something, throwing it out, so we're left with the right view of the Buddha. That's kind of the idea here. The realized one understands this, etc., etc., and those who genuinely praise the realized one will rightly speak of these things. A lot has been elided there. You see the little dots there? A lot is actually missing from the text. What one of the things that is missing in there is this idea that all of these views, like I mentioned before, are based ultimately on feelings. And feelings. We enjoy these views. These views appeal to us because they give us a boost of good feeling or whatever. And it comes from the idea that if you have a feeling that I exist, the asmimana, as it's called in Pali, asmimana means the conceit I am. And if I have that perception that any a philosophy or any viewpoint about the world that affirms that I am, that says, you know, yes, that is true, would then appeal to you, because you feel I am and you have a positive feeling about that, then you will also have a positive feeling about these philosophies. And this is why these philosophies can often become very powerful. Yeah, if some philosophy affirms your deeper kind of intuition, and intuition may be completely wrong, but it affirms that deeper intuition, then you will buy into it. And of course, anyone who then challenges you with these things, you will just dismiss them, because you will say, yeah, you know, this philosophy exists and it fits with my experience and everything, and then you will hold on to these things very, very strongly. Yeah. So we should never be surprised that, you know, people hold on to these eternalist views. And we should not be surprised that the majority of the world's religion are precisely some form of eternalist view. In fact, it is so unsurprising that even within Buddhism, if you try to find out what Buddhist people around the world actually believe, a lot of Buddhist people are also eternalist for exactly that reason. They have somehow been able to interpret the Buddhist teaching in such a way that they read eternalism into the suttas. I don't know how it's possible, but that's what they do. And then they, because the power, the desire to do that is so strong, because it's all based on feelings, what feels good to us. And this is, I think, a very powerful insight, that our views are somehow supported by feelings. Yeah, we are really emotional beings. Emotions are what drive us in the world. And this is why it is so important that when we want to practice the Buddhist path should also ideally be emotional. It should be inspirational, because these are the things that drive us on. Yeah, and hopefully it is driving us on in the right way, because this is Buddhism, so we assume that Buddhism has got it right. So then we are driven in the right way. But if those emotions are then related to some kind of wrong view, it drives you on in the wrong way. And you take up these views that are really problematic and ultimately will block you from achieving the highest things on the Buddhist path. So this is a very, I don't know, it's a really kind of insightful and beautiful, and how this is how all of these views, they arise from that, those feelings that arise. You like it or you dislike it, or you are neutral about it. And it makes you kind of start to question your own views a little bit. Yeah, you think, jeepers, why am I taking these views so seriously when they're just based on, I just feel good about them. All right. So let's move on. So this is now about the non-percipient life after death. Does anyone want to say anything at this point before I move on to this? Okay, good. So this is non-percipient life after death. And this is a little bit strange, how there can be non-percipient life. In other words, it means that there is no perception. And again, I don't think we should take it too literally. We should just understand that there are people who make these claims and they mean something by it. We don't know exactly what they mean by this. They may mean that certain perceptions are not there. But I think the commentary says something like, you identify as perception, but not any particular perception. Yeah, something like that. There's all kinds of strange possibilities. One of the strange things, here we're talking about the views of people who are not Buddhists. Yeah, and we're kind of criticizing those views and saying that they are not really, don't make sense in the larger view of things. But even within Buddhism, just like Ananda was just saying before, we have the asanya-satta, the non-percipient beings. So it seems that even from a Buddhist point of view, there is such a thing as non-percipient existence, where there's no perception at all. It doesn't last forever like this does. It only lasts for a certain while. It is like a lifetime when you are non-percipient. But it seems to be possible. And I have always wondered how it is possible to kind of have an existence where you have no mind. The suttas say that you are just matter at that time, or you're just form, yeah, you're just the rupa, but you don't have any mental qualities. What does that mean? It's really strange. Does that mean that you're like a rock? Does that mean that the rock one day can just wake up? Oh, my life as a rock is finished. Now I carry on. Is that what it means? What exactly does it mean? I find it very hard to get my head around some of these ideas. And I was wondering whether what it means, and this is a slightly philosophical kind of detour. It's not going to take a couple of minutes, but there's this idea found in the suttas and also found in modern philosophy as well, is that when you are conscious of something, there's two kinds of consciousness. One is the immediate awareness of the object, like you have eye consciousness, you see something. And then after you have the eye consciousness, the mind takes that as its own. You think about it afterwards, right? Or you are aware of it in your mind's eye. Like you dream at night, you can see things in your dreams. In other words, your mind has the ability to create forms and create visions, even though you're not seeing anything. So there is the first impression, which is just the eye consciousness. Then it goes to the mind. The thing is that if you just see something with eye consciousness, but it doesn't go to your mind afterwards, you don't go directly to hearing, then that eye consciousness doesn't really have time to solidify in your mind. And it's very, very hard to remember it afterwards. It's only when the mind gets involved that you can remember these things. They have this philosophical language, they call it phenomenal consciousness and metaconsciousness. Phenomenal is just the seeing itself. Metaconsciousness is when you think about the thing afterwards. Meta is this idea of about, not meta as in loving kindness, but meta, the kind of Greek word meta, which means about something. I sometimes wonder whether this could be asanyasata, is that you are conscious, but in a very rudimentary way. You just have this direct experience of something, like seeing, but the mind doesn't take up the object afterwards, so it doesn't actually make any real impact, and we cannot recall it afterwards. And because you can't recall it afterwards, you call it asanyasata, non-perception, non-percipient beings. I don't know, it's just a crazy theory. But, maybe I have too much time sometimes. I don't know why I come up with these things. But, somehow it's nice to be able to have some explanation for these things. And that is kind of my idea about this. What do you think, Venerable? Mitta Vihari?
Good theory.
Okay. Thank you. Ooh, I'm glad. Sometimes it's more... One thing is being challenged by lay people. That's actually because monks are usually more into the suttas. So when they challenge you, you kind of start sweating a little bit more. So that's good. So I'm very happy that he's on board. Anyone have any ideas about that? Do I make any remotely any sense? Yes, please. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether when there's no perception, whether you're not experiencing consciously, you're still observing, but you're just not making a judgment based on something from the past, so there's no judgment. It's almost as if you're consciously living in that particular moment. There's no perception of good, bad, or neutral.
The thing is that, the way the Buddha talks about consciousness, he says that it is impossible to be conscious without having perception. Perception is integral to consciousness. So you're always going to be conscious of something. There's no such thing as consciousness without an object. Object and awareness always go together. So you're going to be percipient of something, even if it is very, very refined. Like this is why you go to the immaterial attainments. You have the perception of nothing. You actually perceive nothing. Oh, this is nothing. Yeah, that is a perception. Which is kind of really strange. I don't know what the perception of nothing actually even means. It's kind of really weird. But there is that perception. So all the way to the very end, and then when you come to the end of perception, consciousness also comes to an end. They come to an end together. They don't really come to an end separately. So that's the thing about this. This is a very important point about consciousness, because if you always have to be conscious of something, then you know that there is no such thing as pure awareness, devoid of any kind of you know, any content, so to speak. Yeah, that such a thing is impossible. And this undermines a lot of the theories about, you know, sometimes people theorize about consciousness being some kind of pure entity that stands alone in the world. But actually, that's impossible, according to the Buddha.
Yeah, in science, they said that when you see something, the mind actually fills in a lot of the gaps.
Yeah.
So our eye doesn't capture every detail, but the mind inputs. So there's like, it's not just eye consciousness, there's this other mind. Attributes.
Right, exactly. And I think that's a little bit what I was talking about before. You see something and the mind takes it as an object and often makes it its own. And then it's really distorted. You know, what you actually saw and what you think you saw can be different different things, you know. This is well known. They have this analysis of insurance companies when there's an accident and they ask all the people, you know, at the accident, who have, kind of the witnesses, and ask them, what did you see? And they all see different things. One saw a car coming from the left, the other one saw the car coming from the, maybe not from the right, but from a slightly different angle. And so they, very often, there's very contradictory these things. This is a well-known phenomenon, how incredibly unreliable our memory is. And that comes from that. What you see is one thing. What the mind then makes out of it is this really kind of random. Yes, is that okay? Yeah, you're not going to ask anything, Manel? I thought you got the microphone. You're just going to hold the microphone. Okay, you're going to help Jake. Okay, great. Okay, everyone. So let us move on to this non-percipient life. I must admit, some of these things I'm not really sure what to make of. As you can imagine, I'm kind of desperately fumbling around to make some sense out of this. It's not easy to make sense of all of this. And maybe that's the point. Maybe it's not supposed to be made sense of. It's just a catalogue of all possibilities. So they assert that the self lives on after death in a non-percipient form on 8 grounds. Asanya, what are the 8 grounds on which they rely? They assert the self is well, arogo, and non-percipient after death, and it is physical. Yeah, physical, it means it has shape or form or physical in some way. So this is a bit like maybe the Asanya Satta we're just talking about. Possibly, don't know, so there is no perception, but somehow it carries on. And then the self that is well, non-percipient after death, and non-physical. This to me sounds very strange. Yeah, it is non-percipient and it is non-physical. What is left? I'm not sure if anything can possibly be left at that point. So from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't really make much sense. But I guess they had their own ideas about what this meant. It meant something special to them, I suppose, whoever was coming up with these ideas. The self is well, non-percipient after death, and both physical and non-physical. It both has form and not form. All right, so that makes a bit more sense, I guess. And the self is well and non-percipient after death, and it is neither physical nor non-physical. So maybe here we may be moving, I don't know where we are now, maybe we are... neither physical nor non-physical. Maybe the perception, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, perhaps something like that, it might be related to that. So again, all of these things are either speculative theories or they are based on some kind of insight according to meditation experience you have. And then you draw a conclusion from that. And the conclusion always goes beyond the data. You have the data, but the conclusion goes beyond what you are. You are actually seeing it. Self is well and non-percipient after death, and it is finite. It is infinite. It is both finite and infinite. It is neither finite nor infinite. 4 different possibilities. Very similar to what we saw before. The ideas of a self that is, you know, you experience these things in your meditation, but here it is non-percipient. So again, it's a little bit difficult to know exactly what is meant. Must be some kind of rupa, some kind of form, because the perception is gone, or it's some kind of limited perception or whatever. something, some idea that someone came up with during the course of history, and then the Buddha is saying, actually, it doesn't really hold water. That's the idea here. These are the eight grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self lives on after death in a non-percipient form. Any ascetics and Brahmins who assert that the self lives on after death in a non-percipient form do so on one or other of these eight grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this, and those who generally praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. So, I didn't mention last time again, but I maybe just bring this up again, this idea that because they're so long between each time we go into the Brahmajala Sutta, I probably say the same thing every time, but I think that's okay. Anyway, I don't mind personally. And the idea here, again, is that, remember, what makes the Buddha special is precisely the ability to see through the deepest aspects of human existence. And this is what this is about, is this ability to understand all the views in the world, yeah, especially views that have to do with the self and who we are and how we exist in the world and these kind of things. And this is really what is the depth of the Buddha's insight. And it means that he can just, he knows all of these views must be wrong simply because they talk about a self that lasts, yeah. In whatever way you speak of a self, whether that makes sense, or even if it doesn't make any sense, you know it must be wrong, because the Buddha understands that there is no such thing as a permanent self. All there is are phenomena that have arisen causally depending on a variety of conditions. So this is all of these things. This is why the Buddha understanding this is so profound, because it relies on his insight into the nature of existence, is relies on his awakening insight. It may not, I don't know how you feel about it. Maybe you think it's obvious that these views are kind of silly, and maybe they are. But this is why it is considered profound, because the Buddha can just, at a stroke, know that this must be wrong because of the insight. This is why this is here. Yeah, this is why the Buddha is praiseworthy, because of this, and not anything else, which is far more superficial. Like, you know, his virtue or whatever else it might be, or his mindfulness or something, yeah. Or even his states of samadhi. Oh, okay, we have some external influence, yeah. Okay, thank you, Jake, yeah. Okay, so we'll take a question from outside. This is from Smita Tenzin. Hello, Smita Tenzin. Question, the consciousness, I apologize if I didn't pronounce your word correctly, your name correctly, sorry. The consciousness will perceive even if it's nothing. You also mentioned that there will be no memory of the perception. Is it possible to not have memory at all? The consciousness will perceive even if it's nothing. Yes, that's exactly right. So even if there's no... even if there is nothing ordinary, my point is that there is the perception of nothingness, the perception that there is nothing, but that itself is a perception. So you cannot... consciousness and perception always go together. So as you say, consciousness will perceive even if there is nothing else, which is the perception of nothingness. So, is it possible to not have a memory at all? It seems it is possible. Yeah, sometimes it seems that if the mind is absent in a certain way, then memories can get lost. Is it possible to erase memory completely? I don't know, because I think if you get a very powerful mind, and you kind of look through the jhana states or the deep samadhi states, then almost everything becomes accessible to you. Almost all memories, everything that happened in the past, becomes accessible to you in a certain way if you direct your mind there. Is it possible that some of those memories might be completely erased? And the answer is, I'm not entirely sure. What I said before about the two kinds of consciousness, a phenomenal consciousness and metaconsciousness, it may be that if something is a pure phenomenal consciousness where there's no metaconsciousness, you just see, but the mind doesn't take it up at all, maybe then it will not be accessible to memory. Maybe. I'm speculating. I don't really know. And but certainly if you do have very strong samadhi, it's amazing what you can remember. Yeah, past lives, everything really. And we have a question from Petra Carmen from Germany. Can I experience this non-perception in the seventh jhana where there is nothing to perceive? Thanks. I like your talks very much. Okay, that's very kind of you to say that. I have to be careful now so I don't get kind of conceited by your kind kind words there. Well, the seventh jhana is not a non-perception. That's the point. Yeah, that seventh jhana is not. First of all, it's not actually a seventh jhana. There's only four jhanas, and there is four immaterial attainments. That is an important distinction because the jhanas are part of the Noble Eightfold Path, whereas the immaterial attainments are not. So they're not really called jhanas. Jhanas are part of the path. Immaterial attainments are not. It is not a non-perception, that's the point. It is a perception of nothingness. That is different. Non-perception is very different from perception of nothingness. You are still perceiving. What you perceive is nothingness. And there is no such thing as consciousness without perception. So it is just an empty kind of perception where there is nothing to hold on to within that perception, if you know what I mean. Okay, so let us carry on. And now we come to the next eight views here. Neither percipient nor non-percipient life after death. I'll come back to these any questions that come in afterwards. So now we come into neither percipient nor non-percipient. So this is similar to the fourth immaterial attainment in Buddhism, the nevasanya nasanya ayatana, the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. So there are some ascetics and Brahmins who say there is life after death and assert that the self lives on after death in a neither percipient nor non-percipient form on eight grounds. Very repetitive all of this, but so please just hang in there. And what are the eight grounds on which they rely? They assert the self is well and neither percipient nor non-percipient after death, and it is physical, or it has form. So again, it is kind of well, it is permanent, there's no changeability, it is neither percipient nor non-percipient, and it is physical. And this is kind of very different from Buddhist ideas, because in Buddhism there is no rupa left in this realm, there is no shape, or form or physicalness at all. So this is probably is some kind of theoretical idea of what can be done rather than based on experience. Probably, but maybe not. Maybe experiences can be had that may be interpreted in this way as well. And then they assert a physical, a self that is well and neither percipient nor non-percipient after death, and it is non-physical. Well, this would be very close to the fourth jhana in Buddhism. Or maybe the immaterial attainments. It is both physical and non-physical. It is neither physical nor non-physical. Again, I'm not sure what that would mean. It seems to mean neither mental nor material. I'm not sure what's left, but anyway. Finite, infinite, both finite, and neither finite nor infinite. So it's neither percipient nor non-percipient, and neither finite nor infinite. So it's like you're denying everything almost. It is neither this nor that, nor this nor that. And again, it's hard to really know what is left. But again, don't be too concerned about what all of these things actually mean. I don't think it's really the point that they necessarily mean anything. The idea is just to have a full catalogue of possible ideas about how to survive after death. And once you have a full catalogue, there's nothing left, well, okay, then you know that the idea of survival after death is always going to be wrong. I think the reason why the Buddha does this is because he knows how tricky the mind is. If the mind is able to create a little corner in samsara where the self lives on forever after, the mind will create that corner. And so you have to be very complete in the way you describe the various possibilities of survival. Because if you're not complete, someone will guaranteed find you some kind of escape clause, yeah? Some kind of way of getting out of this. Because this is what the mind is like. The mind is so tricky here. We always want an escape clause, yeah? Get out of jail for free card. This is kind of the idea. And you will kind of, I found the way through the Buddha. I found the loophole in the Buddha's teaching. Okay, well, I'm really happy. So this is what the Buddha forgot, yeah? And I have seen the real self. The Buddha didn't really see it. So I know the truth of this. Something like that. This is how we function as human beings. We want that self to exist in one way or another. All right. These are the eight grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self lives on after death in a neither percipient nor non-percipient form. Any ascetics or Brahmins who assert that the self lives on after death in a neither percipient nor non-percipient form do so on one or other of these eight grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this, and those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. So there you are. These are the kind of we've just done 32 now out of 44 views, another 12 views to go. And these are kind of just almost like a catalogue, yeah? It's kind of it's just one thing said after the other. There's not much, all that much information in there. But these are the idea of survival after death in one way or another. Coming up next is annihilationism, which is also about the future. But before we go on to that, I will take a few more questions. So then anyone here would like to say anything about what we have seen so far? It's hard to know what to ask, isn't it, with these things? It's kind of all a bit unsure. Ananda, you always, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Ajahn, these are anyway all the wrong views.
Yep.
So these may be the views that those people like Makkali Gosal and all those people who have been spreading. So is the message that the Buddha is giving is that, look, these are the wrong views.
Yeah.
And I think in many suttas, you have taught us, Ajahn, that I think that those who hold wrong views, if one is continuing to hold the wrong view, the way is to the lower down realms.
It depends on the kind of wrong view, and it depends on, you know, one of the things the Buddha says in that he does say that wrong view has bad consequences normally, but he also says, and this is kind of the interesting part, this is what you find in the standard explanation for understanding the law of karma. He says that for those people who have wrong view and act according to the wrong view, so that you have to live in accordance with the view.
Yeah.
And if you don't live in accordance with it, you may ask, do you really believe it anyway? Maybe you don't really believe in it if you don't act according to it. So it is the real belief in those views and the acting in accordance with it, which usually means you do bad things as a consequence. Yeah, that I think is a significant issue. If you just believe in a creator God, that would be a wrong view because it's eternalism. It doesn't mean that if you are a Christian, you go to hell. It doesn't really mean that. From a Buddhist point of view, if you are a good Christian and you live well, you will still go to a heavenly realm. In fact, I have mentioned here before that in some of these heavenly realms, you have the various corners of the heavenly realm. You have the Christian corner of the heavenly realm. You have the Muslim corner of the heavenly realm, or the Buddhist corner. make sure you go to the Buddhist corner when you get reborn in heaven, Ananda, yeah? Hang out with your Buddhist Deva friends. Maybe you have the atheist corner, you have the agnostic corner, you have the Thor and Odin corner, yeah? I don't know what you have, but the point is that these views, it really is bad views, and kind of classical really bad views are the views of, as you say, Makkali Gosala. Yeah, that is really problematic. Yeah. He's the one who has the view that if you go on the northern bank of the river Ganges and you slaughter all people and you build this enormous mountain of flesh out of all the beings you slaughtered, no bad karma. And if you go on the southern side of the river Ganges and you give out and you dole out and you help everyone in the whole world, you make no good karma as a consequence. So do whatever you like. Now that is bad. And if you really believe that and you follow accordingly, that is when you have real problems. Yes.
But normally what happens, Ajahn, is that your action is sort of derived from your beliefs normally. Yeah. So that's why I think the Buddha has brought the right view right at the top.
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
That is the preceding factor. So
I think that's true. Yeah. I think sometimes people say these things, that if you have wrong view, you automatically have a bad destination. And there are a few places in the suttas where they say things that look like that. But I think that you have to place it in context with what you see in the standard gradual training, where it says it's not just the wrong view, but it's actually you're acting upon that wrong view. I think then that is the right interpretation. Otherwise, it sounds too extreme. We end up becoming like the Christians. If you don't believe in Buddhism, then you are doomed to hell. Yeah, and I think that is too narrow-minded. I don't think it's true, even, to be honest.
Can I just ask another question?
Yeah, please.
That specifically about anything. You also highlighted to us during, I think, the dependent origination time, that Kacchanagata Sutta.
Mm, mm.
Would you say that sutta is an absolute summary of this? The two, I think it is all exist or all non-exist.
Yeah.
And in between is what I thought Buddha says.
Absolutely, yeah.
So in that little sutta, all this is there in a very precise form.
Exactly, and that's why that sutta is so profound, because it includes all of this and more, actually, as well, and more.
And
the kind of the middle way, where the Buddha says, I teach the Dhamma by the middle, and that by the middle is dependent origination specifically, and so, yes.
Actually, Ajahn Ram said in the last retreat that when there was a question about the middle way, he said there are two ways of looking at middle way.
Yeah.
That's how I remember this Kacchanagata Sutta. So he said that one is the middle path, that is the Noble Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Other one, he said, what is from the Kacchanagata Sutta.
Yeah, exactly.
The middle way according to the dependent origination. So that's how this thought came to me while looking at this. So.
Yes, usually it is this whole sutta can actually be summarized just in what is called Sasata Ditti, eternalist view, and Ucheda Ditti, which is the annihilationist view. And those two sides, all of this is really included in that. And I think the Buddha is kind of trying to put some meat on the bones, because very bare bones, only having two views. So here he's kind of expanding on it to make it more clear what these things actually mean. And I think that's kind of the point,
not that I know very scant knowledge of Pali, but here you mentioned the word Sasatavada. But in that sutta, it's Ajahn, different word, isn't it? Attitancha?
Attitanchana. There is and there is not.
There is not.
Yeah. But the idea is that atti means atti in the complete sense, in the sense that it exists as an independent entity, like a self. How does it go again? Attitansha, natitansha, the existence-ness and non-existence-ness.
To the same thing, I think.
Yeah, refers to the same thing, yeah. Same thing. Excellent, thank you. Yes, please, fire away. Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. So just to you want to say it again?
Yeah, that was just a comment that I observed because I've been born Christian.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the conditioning is that you're born to other religions, you have whatever the conditions are, sometimes you don't get a say. So, and Buddha was born a Hindu. He wasn't born a Buddhist. So he must have progressed to the level he was going to become a Buddha through other religions and other belief systems. So thank you to the Buddha for that.
Yeah.
He self-realized.
Yeah.
Whereas we might be lucky to be born Buddhist on some occasions to hear the Dhamma and evolve.
Yeah.
So my question to you, I certainly can see what is not the right way.
Mm.
So being a Christian for 30 years and now Buddhist for 20 years.
Mm.
So my understanding of Nibbana, like you said, my mind always questions it. Because, you know, the idea of extinguishment is very, very difficult. Because there's Nibbana and then Parinibbana. Mm. So you go, oh, you're extinguished, but you still live and you still have consciousness and perception. So the idea is that the latent energy still continues till you die. But you don't create any more energy once you realize the full truth.
Mm.
So there's some extinguishment. So I'm trying to even think about physics and chemistry.
Mm.
And you're still living as a sentient being, but some other energy is continuing for you to have no living energy anymore. But you're still experiencing the mind states and the physical states.
Yeah.
It's very unusual.
So first of all, let's cut back to what you said first before I answer that one. The idea that, yes, you can belong to another religion, and yes, you can make progress on the path, by being kind and living well and all of these kind of things. Absolutely, you can have mindfulness and get into deep meditation, for goodness sake, and be a Christian or a Muslim or anything, really. But at some point, if you're holding on to an idea of permanence, you're going to have to let go of that at some point. Because if you don't let go of that idea, of course, you're not going to be able to see impermanence because they are two opposites. Yeah. So you have to let go of some of the doctrines or ideas, not the experience, but the doctrines that you have. If you have a doctrine of permanence, you have to abandon that at some point, or at least be open to the possibility that there might be a different way of looking at things. So you can go a long way, but you can't really, you know, you can't really be a Christian who believes in an eternal God and also be an Arahant. That's impossible because they are two opposite things, really. Yeah. Then there's a question of the Buddha. Was he a Hindu? Well, that actually, it's an interesting question, and I would say that it is not clear that he was a Hindu. He grew up in a society where a large part of the society was Brahmanical. It's not really Hindu anyway, because this is a very early days, long before the Hinduism that we have now. It was a very much more simpler kind of religion. It's called Brahmanism usually, because it was a teaching of the Brahmins, the highest caste in India at that time. Well, actually, they may not even have been the highest caste at that time, which is fascinating. The Kshatriyas, the aristocrats, or the nobles of society may have been a higher caste still at that time. But remember, the society then was a very interesting society with lots of different religions, and they were all kind of competing with each other. And you had two main movements, and one of the main movements was the Brahmanical movement. This was the establishment, the kind of main force in society, the main kind of establishment in society that everyone would go to have funeral ceremonies and these kind of things. But then there was the heterodox teachers, as they're sometimes called. The orthodox are the Brahmins, the heterodox are all the samanas. The samanas are the ascetics, or the recluses, whatever you call them. And they were actually not part of the Brahmanical or Hindu movement at all. They were different. They were like the Jains. It is often said the Jains were there before Buddhism, in ancient India. And there were obviously a large number of schools. And I would guess that just like today, like me, when I grew up, I was nothing. I grew up in a country that is supposed to be Christian. I was part of the kind of Lutheran church, because the moment you're born, you get baptized, you get stamped into the church, whether you want to or not. What can you say when you're a baby? You can't really protest. I should have protested. That would be really cool. The baby saying, don't, I don't want to be part of this. But that's kind of out of the question. So I was just a nominal Christian. Yeah, I wasn't in a Christian by any way. And I think maybe it was similar at that time of the Buddha. Many people were just not really this or that. They were just open to various possibilities. They were still kind of trying to find their way. And maybe the Buddha was the same. I'm not sure whether he ever considered himself a Brahmin or a Hindu. There's no real record, as far as I know, in the Sutta of the Buddha saying that he is considered himself a Hindu or anything like that. So it's a bit uncertain. And now coming to your last question about Nibbana and what it means to kind of, what does it mean to be enlightened? What does it mean? Why does the body carry on? And then when you die, everything stops and you reach extinguishment. How is that possible? And I think the way I like to think of that is that when you become an arahant, what you do is you stop looking for happiness in the future. You stop trying to achieve things. This is what our life is about. It's always about achieving things. It's always about moving towards something, moving towards some kind of satisfactory state. Our whole life is about that. We are driven by craving. Yeah, everything's about finding a good relationship. Everything is about finding a nice place to live, having a good career. Yeah, and even when you grow old, you still have this drive towards something until the moment you die. And when you die, well, at the very least, you have the craving to be reborn, to carry on. So there's always this drive towards some kind of imagined future. That is what our life is about. That's what craving really is about. But that is what the arahant has given up. The arahant knows that there is actually no happiness. There's nothing satisfactory to be found in the future. What is to be found? If you want to find happiness, you find it now, in the present moment. You close your eyes, you watch your breath, you go into a state of bliss. Nothing in the world outside can even remotely be compared to a state of bliss you can find within. That is where happiness is to be found. So the happiness comes from giving up the craving, to becoming still within. That is where happiness is found. So for that reason, there's no looking into the future to find anything interesting or positive. So that is called sankhara, and sankhara is what the arahant has given up, this process of creating a future that might be interesting, yeah, or you think is interesting. Yeah. And then, because you still have a body, and because this body has a certain momentum to it, the momentum of the body, you're born into this world, the body just doesn't stop just because you become an arahant. The body carries on until you die, when the body dies of natural causes, because that momentum is already there with the body, then everything comes to an end. That's extinguishment. So you're already extinguished in a certain sense, but the physical aspect of the body keeps you going until you die, and then everything comes to an end. Something like that.
So what happens to the mind after the Nibbana? You're still perceiving and...
After Nibbana, everything is extinguished. Ding! Highest happiness.
So your mind doesn't perceive and you're not conscious?
Well, if you're conscious, you're still suffering. You don't want to be conscious.
You're not conscious.
Yeah,
okay.
Because if you're conscious, then suffering. This is kind of the point. This is the point of Buddhism, is that
it's hard to contemplate.
Yeah, if you don't want to suffer, right? So you don't want to be conscious. So there's the end of suffering here. Otherwise, you're still hanging on to stuff, still attached to things, still attached to a self. Yeah, that is exactly the self we're talking about here. That consciousness that you are looking for after. I don't know if you're looking for it, but you're asking. That consciousness, whatever that might be, is precisely the kind of self that we're talking about here.
I remember in one of the suttas, the Buddha says to Anand, it's very pleasant to go to the river. Let's go to the river today.
Yeah. Okay.
This particular, so he's already perceiving and remembering. Yeah. So his mind still continues, I would think.
Yes. His mind continues until when he dies, it stops. Yeah. Microphone.
I'm just on a sidetrack, just adding into so that I don't know whether I know the lady don't get so blocked with Nibbana and Arahant. What I think, because we got Ajahn Brahm as a teacher here, and if you have come for meditation a lot, and Ananda was mentioning the sutta of this, I can't know the Pali word, exists or not exists.
Oh yeah, Kacchanagata Sutta.
You got to really tie up properly with what our Ajahn teacher teaching us. We cannot see yet, but the world, if you go into the jhana world and you go into the, just by itself go to the four jhana world, you really saw the ceasing of the world and the passing of the world. There is a season of one world, and whether you call it heaven world, and then after you, if you got this idealism, that's why you hold on to it and you go on into a rupa attainment, and that is another world you're going into. We can only talk, that is the world, but here we're using the word self, you see. When you are at, whether you're Christian at the, I can't see a Christian going to a rupa world, but that is my opinion, that you can come to me, we'll talk about it later, but if you are a good-hearted person, you just naturally, the brain just, not the brain, sorry, the mind just go into jhana, if you know, whether it's a Christian teacher or jhana, it's stillness go all the way. You see the stillness, once you see the world ended at the fourth rupa, at fourth jhana, you cannot afford to say there's a permanent heaven world that is with, based on five senses. And that's why it's important to differentiate the five sense world and the sixth sense pure mind going all the way to rupa and jhana. And that's where the Kajana Sutta, that line itself is so important. And if you define that line wrongly, I look Chinese, but I literally don't know Chinese. It's very important. Your physical body, mental body, is a lot mixed up through the many. Whatever schools you go into, this world, sorry, I think I better stop because I'm not very clear in what I'm trying to say, but I think it's important to know, you come here, you must know that it's many different worlds. You must be in meditation to...
Yeah, okay, so you're basically saying that something about... Yeah, okay, good. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. No? Okay. Let's take a couple of questions from outside. We have one from Bhavani Chandrasekhar, who asks, where will these realms be living? Where are these realms? Or, I guess, where will you hang out? And the thing about these realms is that they're not really located in space in an ordinary sense. Yeah. So it depends really what these people mean. I mean, remember, all of these realms are just ideas of people who are not Buddhist. And so I don't know what philosophy lies behind this, whether they are perceiving this as belonging to a particular place or whatever. I have no idea. But from a Buddhist point of view, all of the realms where you can exist, yeah, the counterpart to the jhanas, the counterpart to the immaterial realms, they're not really located in space, because when you enter these realms, there is no space anymore. Yeah, you're gone beyond this perception of space. You've largely gone beyond the perception of time as well. There's no time and space really at all, which is kind of weird. Yeah, no time and space. So what is there? Well, there's just like bliss. That's what it is, without time and space. Strange, isn't it? So where are they? Well, they are nowhere, or they are right here. There is no, you can't really differentiate these realms from what you're perceiving now. Yeah, and you know, in Buddhism, we also talk about the Peta Loka, Peta or Preta, Preta in Sanskrit. These are the realms of the ghosts. So where are the ghosts? Well, they too are probably just right here. There is no separation. There's no separation in time and space. They're probably right. You can't see them because they are, the form they have is of a different type than the form we have. It is more subtle. So that's why you can't see them, but they're probably right here. Yeah, so that's why people sometimes can see pretas. Sometimes you see a ghost. I saw something really weird. What is this all about? So there is no separation in space. They exist kind of almost right here with us. When you read some of the suttas, it says that they talk about what is called the loka dhatu. Loka is world, dhatu means like element. So this means something like a solar system. Yeah, it says the loka dhatu consists of the earth, the moon, the sun, earth, moon, and sun. That sounds very much like the solar system, doesn't it? It doesn't mention anything about the other planets, but still, it gives a rough idea of what the basic constituents of a solar system is. And then it says, in that solar system, there are all the realms are there in that solar system. Human beings, animals, the lower realms, all the various Deva realms, all the way up to Brahma Loka, are found in that solar system. They're part of this. They are tied to this. Just like we are tied to the Earth, even though some people, like these kind of people in Silicon Valley, they try to untie us from Earth by wanting to go to Mars or whatever. So I guess we're not so tied to Earth anymore if that happens. But we are tied to this solar system in a sense, yeah? In the same way, all of these other beings are tied to this as well. Yeah? So they are here within the solar system, maybe right here on this Earth. It's just that we can't see them because their form, their being is of such a nature that they're not visible to the naked eye. Yeah? That's what's going on there. Yeah? So they are around, yeah? Anyway, so then we have a question from Daisy Day. How does one ensure one becomes liberated after jhana 4? Instead of carrying on to immaterial jhanas, we do not lead to liberation. How do you ensure you become liberated? Well, if you get to the fourth jhana, very likely you're already partly liberated already, because these jhanas are the foundation for profound insight. Get to the first jhana, get to the second jhana, maybe the third jhana, and do those many times, then liberation will tend to happen as a matter of course. If you are a Buddhist, if you have right view at the beginning, all the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, ending with Samma Samadhi, remember Samma Samadhi is the four jhanas, that is the end of the path. The path only goes so far. And what that means is that awakening happens almost automatically as a consequence of deep samadhi. So you go to deep samadhi. If you want to be precise about how it happens, then the suttas say the way it happens is that you review or you reflect on the constituents of those jhana experiences. And the constituents that you reflect on is specifically the five khandhas. Yeah, whatever is left of the five khandhas. When you get to the jhanas, only a very small amount of existence remains. And that small amount of existence is the remnant of the five khandhas in the jhana states. Yeah? What is left is just a bliss, yeah, perception of that bliss. The will is gone, the body is gone, there is awareness, yeah, tiny bit of reality left. So almost everything has already been abandoned. It has already been seen as dukkha, as impermanent, as non-self. Now you need to see these remnant of the five aggregates as impermanent, dukkha, as suffering, and as non-self, anatta, anatman. That is what you do. So you focus on those things as impermanent. Yeah? So you think, okay, jhana state, wow, this is so blissful. This is the meaning of life. I just touched the meaning of life. Now, having touched the meaning of life, you have to understand that that meaning of life is not the final stage. That too needs to be understood as impermanent. And because it is impermanent, it is suffering because you can't control it. It is not an eternal mind, as we are suggesting in the sutta here, Brahmajala Sutta. It actually is impermanent. How do you know that? Because you enter it, then you come out. If you think that's permanent, you are adding something to the experience that is not inherent to the experience. And that is where you go completely wrong. And when you start to understand that even these things, these most blissful things that are possible to attain in the human experience, that too is subject to impermanence and suffering, well, then you give that up too. And when you give that up too, that's when enlightenment happens. You don't need to go to the immaterial realms at all. In fact, I think very few people do. The vast majority get enlightened somewhere in the four jhanas. That is sufficient to achieve awakening here. Okay, we can take some more questions, I think. So, Jake, if you could fire away, if you like. So, I'm happy to do that. Anyone else here who want to say anything about after this? I'm going to stop in a second because it's getting already getting a bit late. But it's nice to give people a chance to ask questions, I reckon. Does anyone feel completely bamboozled as to what is going on? Or is everyone okay? Yeah. very few people admit that they are bamboozled, right? Usually they're... One of the nice things about the Dhamma is that it sort of it grows over time, you know. And I'm sure most of you probably understand roughly what's going on. But to really understand these things, you have to allow these things to grow and gradually become deeper and deeper. And this is the amazing thing about the Dhamma. You know, you read a sutta and then you think, yeah, I understand this. And you come back a year later or 2 years later and you read it again. You think, actually, I didn't really understand it at all. Now I understand it. You come back 2 years later and think, actually, I didn't understand it then, but now I really get it. And you carry on like that until you become a stream entry, right? And then that's when you understand it fully for the first time or final time, so to speak. So it's this deepening of things about the suttas. And that's one of the joys of reading them, is the kind of gradually your view is starting to align more and more with the view of the Buddha. Yeah. And as your view aligns with the word of the Buddha, you're starting to see the world as the Buddha saw it. That's really what right view is all about. And as I said in my talk on Friday, the right view really comes down to one thing, and that is the view, understanding the difference between happiness and suffering. That's really what right view ultimately is about. You understand where to find happiness and where suffering is to be found, and you want to avoid the two. You want to avoid the suffering and move towards happiness. Sorry. Okay, so here are the questions. Here they are. So let's have a quick look at these remaining questions. This is from a fellow called Ted Lands. Hello, Ted. Do you think the Buddha was indirectly addressing the reason underneath these scenarios, which is the fear of not having a self? What confuses me is why didn't they just ask the Buddha himself? Since the Buddha clearly had consciousness, clearly had perceptions, yet clearly was not there. Well, what the Buddha is doing, he is not really, it's not about anyone asking him, it's just that the Buddha lives in India, and in India there are all of these ideas. Yeah? So the Buddha is just explaining how his awakening differs from all these existing ideas. He's explaining where these other people go wrong, all the spiritual teachers. And he's saying, well, this is my insight, and it differs from everything else that has existed previously, because everything else has depended on this idea of a self. Yeah. So is it about the fear of not having a self? Yes, that's a very important part of it. Yeah, the fear of not existing. Yeah? And it is driven by this feeling that you exist, and so any theory that supports that feeling will be considered a positive theory, and you will tend to hold on to that. You say, yes, Hinduism wasn't even a religion then. Vishnu and Shiva was not even around. Yeah, it's a little bit unclear whether Vishnu or Shiva were around. They may have existed already. It's interesting when you read the Pali Suttas, you read the Devata Sanyuta, which are the connected discourses on devas or divine beings. There are a couple of being of gods called, one god is called Venu, and Venu sounds very similar to Vishnu. And there's another one called Siva or Shiva, yeah, which sounds very much like the Shiva of later Hinduism. So it may be that they already existed in a kind of embryonic form at that time, but that they were only really written about later on. So it's a bit unclear. There is certainly these names of these gods are many of the gods that you find in the Hindu tradition, even the pre-Buddhist Hindu tradition, are also talked about in the suttas. So there is certainly some connection there. Then we have from Pier Angela, not sure how to pronounce your name properly, but what is the difference between nirvana and parinirvana? Thank you, Ajahn. Well, there isn't really any difference at all. They are the same thing. But there is something called the aparisesa parinirvana and the non-aparisesa parinirvana. And aparisesa means parisesa and aparesa means with the remainder and without remainder. That's really the important distinction. Actually, nirvana and parinirvana don't really mean very different things at all. They mean basically the same thing here. And the nibbana or parinibbana with the remainder is the arahant. Yeah, the arahant is still living in this world, and the arahant has remainder because the body is still here, the mind is still here. And then when they come to their death, that's when you have the aparisesa parinibbana. There's no remainder anymore. Everything comes to an end, cessation, complete ending. That is the important distinction in Buddhism. When the suttas talk about nibbana, or this talk about parinibbuto, which is parinibbana, they usually mean becoming an arahant. They don't mean what happens when the arahant dies. And that's an important confusion often in Buddhism. Nibbana actually means the living state of being an arahant. Okay, everyone. So we've been going on for an hour and a half already. So let's call it a day. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.